in the balcony are made out of butter. Are you fairly comfortable up there, Jerome? Are you all right? Jerome. If this does you any good, the man that's responsible for the cooling tonight is sitting up in the balcony. I think he's trying to convince everybody that it's not as hot as you think it is. He reminds me of the farmer that planted about 20 acres of tomato plants one year, and he planted them early. And there came a frost that night, and just to prove that wasn't all that cold, he slept in his undershirt and took pneumonia and died. But I'm glad you're up there, and maybe it'll teach you a lesson or something. No, these times when we're not really in the summer, we're not in the winter, we don't know how to plant it, so you'll just have to bear with them and bear with us on that matter. This has been a great day, and the contribution, I think, is one of the finest votes of confidence for the eldership here that I've ever seen. And I'm telling you, I've never seen the likes, and I think perhaps there's no good work that we could plan but what you would support. And I thank God for every last one of you. And I know it was a joy to you to have part in this good work here today. I was wondering whether to go on and proceed in the fifth chapter of Matthew or not. I think you benefited by the Beatitudes, and I know that you followed through them very seriously. You thought through them. And you know, thinking is hard work, and people don't really enjoy thinking, but I think you did a magnificent job of genuinely, consistently thinking through these Beatitudes. My mind is a bit tired also from thinking through them. They are very vital to our existence as Christians. I would prefer, frankly, to go into something else, a bit lighter, but I think we would miss the impact and miss the real value if we don't go ahead and make the application that Jesus made of these Beatitudes in some very vital parts of our lives. So, with or without your permission, I'm going to go ahead and pursue this subject through the fifth chapter of Matthew and see what he says is the practical, immediate application of these principles that he mentioned in the Beatitudes. May God bless us as we study it. You know, today and for the last 10 years, we've been hearing much and seeing much of a new, what they call a lifestyle, a new kind of living that is so startlingly different from what generally we are accustomed to. Even those of you of the younger generation, the lifestyle that you are seeing about you among your contemporaries, this lifestyle is different really from what even you are accustomed to. It's different in many respects. And the word lifestyle really is a word, I believe, that has been coined during the last decade to describe any kind of life that a person lives. But it came about, I think, primarily as a new phrase that has been coined to describe this new kind of lifestyle that is completely different. It is a new way of thinking. It is a new way of looking, a new way of dressing, a new way of living, free from anything that would resemble a restraint. Now, I think that's generally what the word lifestyle, that's the origin of the word. Jerry Rubin, whom none of you probably know personally, but perhaps many of you know by reputation, is one of the leaders of this new lifestyle revolution. And Jerry Rubin took a position and holds a position of leadership in that movement. I'm going to say something there that he has written in his book, Do It, entitled Do It. And the subject is not long hair, and you can relax. In fact, none of you fit into this category anyway. But Jerry Rubin signals the nature of this new revolutionary movement. He says that their long, uninhibited, uncut hair resembling a woman is the symbol under which they fly or under which they go. It's the symbol that they fly and the flag they fly to indicate that they're different. Listen to what he says. He said, kids, young kids, identify short hair with authority and discipline, with unhappiness, boredom, rigidity, hatred of life, and long hair with letting go. Wherever we go, our long hair tells people where we stand on Vietnam, Wallace, campus disruption, and drugs or dope. We're living commercial. We are living commercials of the revolution. Long hair is the beginning of our liberation from the sexual oppression that underlies the whole military society. Now, I mention that simply to show that there is definitely a war on, and there is a new lifestyle that is being advocated with the fervor of a newfound religion. Now, I know that this particular lifestyle varies, and I am very confident and very well aware that every kid in the United States or in the world that wears long hair does not share the same motives that those religious or those leaders of this movement possess. And this, the motives differ all the way from naivety on down to sinisterism. And I know that every kid that wears long hair doesn't have sinister motives. Many of them are just naive. But those who led this Reformation, or those who led this revolution, their motives precisely were hatred, rebellion, and revolution. And if you don't believe it, you read their writings and it'll curdle your blood. Read some of the things that these men have said as to the reasons why they're living the kind of life that they're living. These men who led this revolutionary uprising claim to be the champions of sincerity and honesty. They're the ones who claim to be the 20th century champions of real honesty and down-to-earth truthfulness. They're saying, in their expression, just let it all hang out. They're saying that we need to get back to letting our actions represent our heart or represent our insides. And they say, do what you think. Do what you really want to do. And this is their approach to this thing of honesty. There was another movement that began some 2,000 years ago. It also was a call to the people to get back to honesty. It was a call to people to get back to doing what their life really, or what their insides were, to get the insides coordinated with the outside, or the outside coordinated with the inside. It was a new lifestyle. It called upon people to be different. And if you please, it was a similar movement to what we see today, if you'll pardon the expression, in this new subculture. There are many similarities between the two movements. The leader challenged the people who were following him to be different kind of people. He called them back to honesty, saying that their actions should be the reflection of their heart. The circumstances of these two movements, I think, are very similar. In the time of the movement in our century, honesty, morality, and religion had reached a new low. On the other hand, hypocrisy, I think, had reached a new high. In the time of this earlier movement, some 2,000 years ago, honesty and morality and religion had also reached a new low. And hypocrisy, that is, the art of saying one thing and doing something quite different, that art of hypocrisy had reached an all-time high. But I'll tell you, that's as far, really, as the similarity goes. The direction of these two movements, of the one in this 20th century, the latter part of this century, and the one some 2,000 years ago, the direction is as different as day is different from night. Whereas the Jerry Rubins, all are, we could virtually, of the leaders, we could direct them or put them into one camp. The Jerry Rubins type, at least of this movement, deny God, and their quest for honesty does not go any further than just stripping themselves of a mask and allowing the world to look down into their soul, which is completely corrupted and filthy and dirty. And they want the world to see this corruption. And their quest for honesty would simply be to urge those people in the world to simply be uninhibited, to let themselves be seen as the corrupt, vile, vicious people that they are and that they have been through the years. And they urge their advocates and their adherents to just simply spill out all of this viciousness and all the obscenities and all the lust and all the anything else that may have possessed them and may have motivated them in the past. And that's the extent of their quest for real honesty. Whereas the leader of the other movement, and that man's name is Jesus Christ, and I'm sure that you were aware of that, that man does not ask us to deny God. He asks us to emulate God. He asks us to be like God. He asks us not only to be like him, but he says, let me show you what he's like. And he says, be like me. Come to me. Learn of me. And he asks that we then take upon ourselves the beauty of holiness And that it is this difference that Jesus Christ makes in our lives. He does ask us to be different. But the difference that he asks that we make is that we become light of the world, a world of darkness and ignorance and shame and sin and corruption. He says, you're to be lights of this world. He says, I want you to be the salt of the earth, the very preserving power that reaches down into and preserves the world from its innate corruption. He says, I want you to be different in the sense that you uplift, that you enlighten, and that you make better. Jesus Christ is asking us to be different in that way. And that's the two directions. And that's the difference in the two directions of these two movements that have affected so many people. The call of Jesus Christ is a call to be different. And I think you young people, as well as those of us who are older, who are not so much pushed or pulled in that direction of the subculture, but I think you young people are able to see right now, tonight, without any further statement, after having studied a year on this campus and after having studied a year in the worship services here, I believe you see without any question that Jesus Christ calls you to be different from the subculture. Do I misread you? Don't I read you right when I think I know that you're being called and that you understand the call of Jesus Christ is to be different from the subculture? I think I can see that. In fact, I think I've seen a turn this very year. I think our meeting with Jimmy Allen represented this genuine turn that simply says, we understand now, preacher. Get off our backs. We understand what you're talking about. I think you do understand. I think you understand that you're supposed to be different from the Jerry Rubens in the world. I think you understand that you're to be different from the Janis Joplins in the world. I think you understand that you're to be different from what you would call maybe the grassroots movements of the world. If you'll please apply that yourself. I think you were sickened to your stomach with the sad exhibition of godlessness that took place on the stage over here under the name of the grassroots musical movement or musical group. And I think you were sickened over it and you expressed yourself. And that's all well and good. And I think we all understand that, at least the majority do. But if nothing more than a core, if nothing more than a small heart of you recognizes, that's good enough. We'll work on that. But let me ask you something else. Do you understand that Jesus Christ is calling you to be different from what most people consider to be religious? This first understanding, I think, is obvious. He wants us to be different from those who live in just total, absolute, outright corruption and ungodliness. Anybody that can see through a ladder ought to be able to see that, and I think you can see through a ladder. But do you understand that Jesus Christ is asking us to be different from what most people consider to be religious? That's what he's asking. That's what he says here in the 20th verse. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, what's he talking about? He's just simply saying that in my movement, those of you who are my followers are going to have to be different. You're going to have to excel or exceed. You're going to have to be better than what most people look upon as religion or religious or as moral. Are you aware of that? Well, you say, surely he's not asking that. That's exactly what he's asking. He says, unless your religion exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you're not going to make it. But somebody said, well, preacher, back in the time of the New Testament, a Pharisee was the very pinnacle of personal piety. I know that. And then you might quote the proverb that was stated back there and was so well known. If but two men got to heaven, one of them would be a Pharisee and the other would be a scribe. I know that's what was stated back there. And that was what people looked upon as being the very epitome of all that was religious and worth emulating. They looked at the scribes and Pharisees. Surely if they can't make it, who can make it? But Jesus Christ says this, and it's very startling. Unless you do something different from what they're doing, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you're not going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. To me, that is a very startling statement. Let's look at it just a moment. What is the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees? Well, Jesus Christ gives six examples here, and each one of these examples represents where the scribes and Pharisees had failed in measuring up to the righteousness of the law. Listen to what he says, very briefly, six of them. You've heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Again, you've heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not swear falsely, but perform to the Lord what you've sworn. Number five, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Then number six, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now each one of these is an example, not of what the law said, but it was an example of the misrepresentation of the law that had been adopted by the people of Jesus' day and had been foisted off upon people as being what the law actually taught. But Jesus Christ is saying, this is not what the law taught. This is what the misinterpretation says. These misinterpretations were either because of twisting, addition, partial statement, or taking the letter of the law void of the spirit. These four general ways of getting around the law to where the people of Jesus' day became loophole law keepers or loophole lawyers. They were forever looking for some loophole to get around the keeping of the law. And this occupied their time almost 24 hours a day, it seemed. When Jesus Christ said, you've heard that it was said, he was not saying, this is what the law of Moses says, and then now I say to you, I'm telling you something different. That's not what he was saying. Jesus was saying, when he said, this is what you've heard that it was said to you, he was saying, this is what is generally rumored as being what the law says, or this is the general popular interpretation of the law. But I'm telling you what is the true meaning of the law. That's what he's saying, and this is his message. There are those people, I think, who would sell the law short and would have Jesus Christ saying, now the law of Moses says this, but I say this. That's not what he says. For Jesus Christ had clearly stated in verse 19, I have not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill the law. That's verse 17. Don't think that I've come to destroy the law. I haven't, he said. I've come to fulfill it. So you must understand that, first of all, each one of these examples shows how that the Pharisees had failed to fulfill the righteousness of the law. We're going to notice each one of them in particular, not tonight. We're going to notice each one of them individually, one at a time, for two or three reasons. Number one, it is not immediately obvious to those of us in this century as to how these Pharisees failed. Number two, these things that Jesus Christ talks about get right down to the very gut issue of life, if you'll pardon that expression. He talks about things here such as self-preservation and the instinct for self-preservation. He talks about the sexual drive. He talks about the immorality of the day as it had infected the marriage institution. He talks about your word being as good as your bond. He talks about this thing of justice being perverted into self-vindication of anger. He talks about loving your neighbor and what it really and truly means to love your neighbor, and how that it means more than just loving those that love you and hating those that hate you. So Jesus Christ took time, and I think we need to take the time, to examine each one of these real, live, true-to-life, vital issues to see what he's saying about it. For I maintain they may very well be the reason why you and I might make it into the kingdom of God. And so I think it does us well to look at them. What did Jesus mean by righteousness? Well, two things I think we need to recognize. Jesus was not showing them something new to which they had not had access. As I said a moment ago, he was not coming and saying, now the law had said this, but I'm going to tell you something new. That's not what he was doing. He had come not to destroy, but to fulfill. But the second thing, Jesus' use of the term righteousness is different from the way Paul uses it. Now, one boy asked me that some 10 weeks ago or so in talking about those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. He said, how does that measure up to what Paul says about it? Well, I said Jesus and Paul used the term righteousness in two different ways. Paul used the word righteousness as synonymous with justification. As far as the righteousness of men, or men being accounted as righteous, men being accounted as just, justified before God, whether they're worthy of it or not, because of their faith in Jesus. And then Jesus, however, uses the term righteousness not just in that sense. He talks about the term righteousness in the overall total sense, as you would say, justification plus sanctification. Jesus talked about it in terms of a whole system of morality. Jesus would say, unless your, I don't like to use the word lifestyle here, but he's saying unless your moral standard, unless your standard of morality is different from the scribes and the Pharisees, you're not going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. He says, unless your morality, I think we could say, unless your morals are of a higher nature than the scribes and Pharisees, you're not going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. Paul talked about it only as justification, primarily, though he knew, and he said later, and he always tied it in, that justification is not the only and the final reason or justification for grace, that sanctification is the final purpose for grace. Justification plus sanctification is what Jesus Christ talks about here. And the Pharisees had failed on both of these counts. And you know, it shocks me and it makes me sober to realize that it is on these two counts that we ourselves are faced with the most serious challenge of our religion. Whether or not your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees will determine whether or not you enter the kingdom of heaven. The Pharisees and the religious people of Jesus' day did not have justification. Now, that was not because Jesus Christ had not died. It was because of the fact that they did not have any faith. Jesus charged them with this in Matthew 23 and verse 23 when he said, "Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites! You tithe mint and anise and cumin, but you've left undone the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith." He says you've just not left it undone. When Paul wrote to the Romans and diagnosing the spiritual ills of the Israelite people, he said that Israel, who pursued that righteousness which is of the law, failed to succeed in acquiring that righteousness. And you know why he said? Because they sought it as though it were by works, not by faith. There was the problem of the Jewish people. They thought that you could work your way into heaven. They thought that God could be obligated to them by the way they live, in the sense of their good works and this work and that work, all these works that they were doing. And Paul says they stumbled over the stone of stumbling. That's Romans the 9th chapter, verses 31 and 32. Paul says they failed to achieve the righteousness of the law because they sought it as though it were by works and not by faith. Number one, they had no real justification. Number two, they had no real sanctification. It hadn't made one bit of difference on their insides. And sanctification affects the heart, not just the externals. About all the Jew of Jesus' day had was a face lifting. About all he had was his face washed on the outside. Even behind his ears were dirty. He'd only polished the front of his shoes, turn him around to the back, look at the back of the shoes, and they had mud and gunk and everything else on it. That's the general condition of the Jew of Jesus' day. He had a very superficial face lifting, but down inside him, he was the same old corrupt, lusting, hateful individual that he'd always been. And Jesus said, he's missed it. He's missed the very purpose of religion. And unless your righteousness exceeds that, you're not going to get into the kingdom of heaven. Jesus told those Jews about their externals. He said, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, you hypocrites." He says, "You clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside you're full of extortion and rapacity." He said, "You're like whited sepulchres that outwardly appear beautiful, but inwardly they are full of dead men's bones and every unclean thing." He said, "So you also look good on the outside, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and iniquity." And he showed them that they were simply inconsistent. He showed them that their religion was one of hypocrisy, looking good on the outside, but not being at all good on the inside. So actually there was no justification because they didn't have faith. They were trying to establish their righteousness before God on the basis of works. Secondly, there was no sanctification. It hadn't made any difference really about their heart. But you know what? If you'll look real close at what you call nominal Christianity today, you know what it says? Those two things exactly. There's no real faith involved. The majority of the people were taken as babies and sprinkled as babies, knew nothing whatsoever about it. Faith has never yet overtaken them. And secondly, if you look at their lives, I'm afraid you'll find the same concept of morality. That is, cleaning up the outside and leaving the inside untouched. And Jesus says, don't make those two mistakes. You won't make it if you do. But you know why? I think if you see the reason, and if you see their thinking, you'll understand why they made no effort to clean up on the inside. Here's what it is. They didn't think anybody was going to see what was on the inside. Yesterday, we took down the places where we were going on the campaigns. And the ladder has a broken leg on it, and I didn't relish getting way up on the top again. So I just gave it a yank. I didn't know whether the whole curtain would fall down, but it didn't, fortunately. But it left two pins up there. And I said, "Oh, well." I said, "Let's just leave it. Nobody can see that." And then this came to my mind. I said, "Woodruff, you're preaching on that very thing tomorrow night, stupid. Get on up on the ladder and fix it." But I was tempted to say, "Well, because nobody can see it, I'll just leave it." That's what these people thought. Because they felt nobody could see what I'm thinking, then I'll just leave it. Jesus Christ said they do all of their deeds to be seen by whom? By men. They were unconscious of God. When Paul wrote in the 3rd chapter of Romans, he says there is no fear of God in their eyes or before their eyes, which was so much to say they cleaned up just as far as they thought people were going to investigate. And they didn't have this consciousness of God, therefore they didn't clean up on the inside. And let me tell you something, you won't either, unless you have a prior claim on your life that simply says, I know God is watching me and he judges my heart and he judges my thoughts. You're not going to clean up the inside either, friend. You're not going to clean up your speech, you men, unless you think that God is listening to every word you say. When you get into your dormitory room, you're going to curse like a sailor. You're going to do like you've been doing all your adult life because you don't think God is listening. There's your trouble. Ananias and Sapphira were guilty of lying because they thought that Simon Peter was the last court of appeal. And they thought, well, he doesn't know what we've sold our goods for. Therefore, we'll lie about it. You tell him we sold it for so much, and I'll tell him the same thing. And therefore, at the mouth of two witnesses, God struck them dead because somebody else was listening other than Simon Peter. Jesus Christ just simply says, unless your religion has of it this quality, that it is a justification by faith, is yours like that? Or have you simply gone through some externals like the Jews did, expecting some adherence to external creeds and external actions and external ceremonies, that's really all that's necessary? Has it affected your heart? Have you gotten right down to the nitty-gritty of cleaning up the inside as well as the outside? Though you don't commit adultery, have you quit lusting? Though you don't murder, have you quit hating? Though you don't do some things, have you quit doing these other things that are on the inside? This is what Jesus Christ is after. And brethren, if I could get this one point across as we introduce this whole new lifestyle that excels, it's simply this. Jesus Christ expects you to be on the inside what he wants you to be and what you know you're expected to be on the outside. Clean them up both. And he says, unless you have this dual operation in your life, you'll never get into the kingdom of God. And believe you me, that makes us think. Unless your righteousness exceeds the scribes and the Pharisees' righteousness, unless your morality, unless your moral standard of conduct exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you're not going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. Which is so much to say, you better depend upon faith to be that which justifies you. You better depend on Christ justifying you through faith. And it better reach down into the very recesses and every nook and cranny of your heart and begin to transform you inside and out, or else you're not going to make it into the kingdom of God. You'll do all right in America. They won't put you in jail. But when it comes time for the doors of the kingdom of heaven to be opened and you entered into it, an abundant entrance into the kingdom of God, you're not going to make it there. Not unless you've had a renovation inside and out. Facelifting won't do when it comes to Christianity. All right, with that introduction, think on it. Let's study next week then this thing of hating and murder. And we'll get down to one of the very most basic motives and one of the most basic things in a man's life or a woman's life. And we urge you to do some thinking with us along that line then next Sunday evening. Tonight, we urge you to come if you want to make your life right with God, if you want to get right on the inside and on the outside, if you want to be justified by faith in Jesus through faithful obedience to his word, then we urge you to come tonight. If you believe that he's the Son of God, come surrender yourself to him in holiness or with a desire for holiness, turning you back upon sin and upon ungodliness. He'll save you and begin this genuine walk with Jesus Christ and walk into this new lifestyle that excels. And without it, you'll never see God. We hope that you'll decide to come while we stand and sing.
Come unto